CP Podcast 187. So there will absolutely be patients in your clinical practice where it seems like they have sciatica, but actually their symptoms are down to something like peripheral artery disease, or a B12 deficiency, or a diabetic neuropathy. How do we clinically reason and differentiate these conditions in practice? Thankfully, we have Adam Dobson to take us all through it. Let's dive in. Thank you so much for joining us once again to MSK and spinal specialist consultant physiotherapist, Adam Dobson. Great to see you. How's things?
Very good. Thank you, Khaled. Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us today for a topic of discussion that I know many physiotherapists would love to hear your insights on. And that is when what seems to be sciatica isn't actually sciatica. So I suppose my first question is, maybe along the lines of what is sciatica in some ways, because it, as you've written here in your notes, it's quite an ambiguous term. When can we be relatively confident that our patient does indeed have sciatica, first of all?
Yes. Yeah, so the I talk about the Stein's criteria quite a lot, but radicular pain, painful radiculopathy, radicular pain plus minus radiculopathy, it's quite a specific condition. So it's pretty clear when a person has radicular pain. It's quite unique. There's a couple of items, usually pain below the knee, leg pain worse than back pain, usually a new problem, some degree of sensory deficit, paresthesia, hypoesthesia, which is the technical term for numbness. So there's a cluster of signs and symptoms that would increase your confidence that this person had painful radiculopathy.
Superb. Actually, that's a really good point. We'll reference and put a link to the Stein's criteria in the description for the podcast, because we've got a good slide on that you can use. And then when patients are reporting their symptoms, in addition to the Stein's criteria, we're thinking about those things, as you said, but we can also have somatic back pain as well. How does that factor into thinking to you?
Yeah, so anecdotally, from what I can see, it's certainly not something that's been researched a great deal, but I think that somatic referred pain, which is pain radiating into the leg from the soft tissues of the lumbar spine, so noxious stimulation of muscles, joints, tendons, facets, that kind of thing, I actually think it's probably more common than proper radicular pain. So 60% of patients with back pain will have some degree of leg pain involvement, if it means it's kind of creeping into the buttock or into the thigh. And the majority of those patients, from my perspective, are somatic referred pain or non-specific lower back related leg pain patients. So they're kind of it's mechanical in essence, and that group of people may well think that they have sciatica, but sciatica as a term has no operational definition. It's not a scientific term at all. It's a lay word to mean a bunch of different things, all of which mean different things to different clinicians. It's a very vague term. So certainly between clinicians, I wouldn't use that word sciatica specifically.
Super. Instead, painful radicular pain or painful radiculopathy?
Yeah. Or sensory radiculopathy, if they only have numbness within a given dermatome, or a motor radiculopathy, or painful motor radiculopathy, or somatic referred pain. If you're not sure, just say leg pain.
Why not? Let's summarize for everyone. Somatic referred pain, as you said, is where we hypothesize that a patient has pain which is referring to the legs, from soft tissue structures within the lumbar spine. So that is somatic, not related to the nerves. And then when we talk about radicular or radiculopathy, these are symptoms stemming from the nerve root. I sometimes use the phrase R equals R, radicular equals root, to help people remember that it's stemming from the nerve root. And then, as you said, it could be sensory radiculopathy, where it's sensory symptoms, motor radiculopathy, where it's motor symptoms, painful radiculopathy, and those are much better terms than sciatica. But hopefully what people can see there is the difference between somatic being soft tissue and radicular being nerve root. So that's great. So then when we talk about other conditions that may mimic a nerve-related leg pain, I've got a couple of ones here to ask you about, Adam, if you don't mind. First of all, is vascular. We talk about a condition, PADS, peripheral artery disease, that can sometimes present with leg pain that patients may feel as if it's of a neurological cause. What is this? How do you interpret it? What signs do you look for that might help you differentiate versus some kind of radiculopathy?
So peripheral artery disease is technically diagnosed using an ABPI investigation, ankle brachial plexus index test. And so they'll be, if you're not symptomatic, you're not going to get that test. But there's going to be people moving around who technically meet the criteria for peripheral artery disease. In terms of symptomatic peripheral artery disease, it's a narrowing and a stenosis and occlusion of the blood vessels, the large blood vessels that move down from the aorta through the iliacs and into the legs. So through atherosclerotic changes, the blood flow can be reduced to the muscles and the muscles ache when you're exerting yourself, basically. So thigh pain, calf pain, knee pain, any pain into the leg in certain distributions can mimic musculoskeletal conditions. So we need to be mindful of non-musculoskeletal conditions so we don't misdiagnose them, we don't manage them incorrectly. So on my course, and I talk about quite readily, is identifying signs and symptoms, pattern behaviors of symptoms, demographics, risk factors, certain tests that we can do as musculoskeletal clinicians in order to decide is this a masquerading condition like PADS.
Excellent. So we're talking about vascular changes, and you explained that really nicely in terms of how blood vessels are not allowing the right blood flow to these muscles, and that can cause aching, and therefore we might be thinking about patients who have cardiovascular risk factors, those who might be overweight, for example. But I think a key point that you mentioned also is the fact that we expect these symptoms are likely to be present on exertion, because of course that's when the cardiovascular system is being stressed and overloaded. So that's a really good question to ask patients, that is this coming on more so when you are doing physical exercise or something of that variety. So that's great. I've got a couple of strange ones, if I may. One is B12, because I've heard B12 deficiencies, and B12 is a particular vitamin, I suppose, that we have in the body. And B12 deficiencies can lead to symptoms that may mimic neurological back pain. Any thoughts on this?
A few. B12 leading to sensory changes in the legs. It's a type of peripheral neuropathy, otherwise referred to as a polyneuropathy. The other term that you might see is the term length-dependent polyneuropathy, and there are a bunch of them. B12 can cause polyneuropathy, but so can diabetes or alcoholism or some kind of toxicity from chemotherapy treatments. And these tend to all be length dependent. What that means is that it generally affects the long axons that enter into the leg and into the feet. So B12 is required for the process of maintaining the myelin. So any breakdown of the myelin can hamper nerve conduction. It can also lead to a rise in neurotoxic substances that interfere with the myelin and axon transportation. Peripheral nerves are also very metabolically demanding. So any reduction in nutrition disproportionately affects the long length dependent axons. So there's kind of three general kind of ways to look at this, because there's over 200.
Wow.
This is an amazing fact. There's over 200 different causes of polyneuropathy. So I don't think as musculoskeletal clinicians, we should be expected to know all of those things. And to be picking up on all of those things. So first of all, risk factors. So when we look at B12, there's a couple of conditions that maybe make patients susceptible. So highly restrictive diets is one. So vegans, elite runners. People are very restrictive with their diets. People who've had gastric bands and gastric bypass surgery, inflammatory bowel like Crohn's disease, they can be deficient of vitamins, including B12. Pernicious anemia, those on PPIs in the long term, and also metformin, which is a medicine that you'd see a patient with diabetes being taken. So if you suspect a person might have polyneuropathy, we want to be thinking about risk factors. So looking at their cardex, looking at their referral, looking at their medication list, just kind of have an idea of some things that the patient may be presenting with. Next, it's signs and symptoms. So these generally start bilaterally in the feet, with numbness and pain in the feet. They might describe neuropathic symptoms like prickling and shooting pain, hypoesthesia. And then it kind of starts to creep up to the knees in a kind of stockings kind of distribution. And then over time, they can start developing similar symptoms in their hands. So if you get a patient with painful feet, numbness in their feet, kind of variable symptoms that they describe, this stocking kind of sensation, you might just pause for thought to say, could we be seeing a neuropathy related to a condition that they already have? Or could this be the beginning of a diagnosis of a condition that's yet being discovered? And you may then consider some basic investigations, including B12 in a blood test. So as well as considering risk factors for some of these neuropathies, B12 in this case, and as well as considering signs and symptoms of length-dependent neuropathy and perhaps the condition itself, B12 deficiency in this case, we could also consider just atypical presentations that might be concerning from a neurological or kind of serious pathology perspective. So rapid or progressive sensory or motor loss, profound muscle weakness or muscle wastage, patchy, widespread or asymmetrical or even asynchronous patterns, marked sensory ataxia is one of them. Non-length dependent patterns of sensory dysfunction, weakness in the trunk, weakness in the proximal muscles, for instance, like the hip flexors, and co-committent systemic features like unintentional weight loss, fever, night sweats, that kind of thing. So if we identify any of these types of things, we may be needing to chat over with a colleague or considering kind of time-sensitive onward referral.
Superb. I think this is actually really important, Adam, if you don't mind me clarifying this, because the kind of things that you've mentioned a second ago is really valid clinical reasoning. Am I right in thinking that when we're looking at sensory radiculopathy, we're thinking about dermatomes, so we're looking at specific areas of the legs, whereas as you've mentioned with these polyneuropathies like the diabetic or the B12, we actually don't necessarily expect them to present in a dermatomal pattern. In fact, they present in much more global areas, like, as you said, the whole foot, not just a certain area of the foot, not just the lateral side like S1 does, but actually the whole foot. And as you said, it then presents in a stocking-like distribution. And if I may, when we're talking about stocking-like, does that mean the whole leg? Because the whole leg would be covered by a stocking rather than just a certain part of the leg. Would I be right in clarifying that?
Yep, absolutely.
Super. This is crucial. And I think that sometimes it's going to that level of detail for clinicians to say, right, you said you've got numbness. Where is your numbness? Oh, it's on both legs. Okay. And where in the foot? Oh, it feels like it's a little bit all over. And then it kind of travels upwards from the feet up. These are things that we don't expect from radicular or nerve root pathology. If I'm right with all that, Adam, that's really great differences that we can spot with our patients if we ask the right questions. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think as well, say if we are talking about central changes that patients with stenosis get. So going back to both with vascular and with lumbar, so we use the term claudication, don't we? It's claudicating, meaning it's reproduced with exertion from a vascular perspective. But with the stenotic patients, they often say that the numbness in the leg is reproduced when they're standing and walking. So there's a kind of like a positional pattern, there's a preference to certain activities. And these patients may not describe that. They may say that this is all the time, or maybe when they're laying in bed and their feet are hurting and they're prickling away and the numbness is variable. So these often don't have these kind of on-off patterns that you would expect with a stenotic patient, for instance.
Superb. That's great reasoning. Thank you so much. I know this is going to sound like a stupid question. It's not intended to sound like a stupid question. But when it comes to these polyneuropathies, of course, you mentioned a diabetic neuropathy, and these are really common. So the silly question is, how much should we be looking at diabetes in the patient's past medical history when they have these leg pains?
Certainly. So we need to consider competing reasons for their symptoms. And it might be nothing to do with our involvement. It could be something that the GP is already aware of. There may be a podiatrist in that patient's care. They should be under the diabetes team. They often do these checks. So you can often look through the record and see evidence of certain testing. So they use monofilament testing, 10-gram monofilament testing, to look at protective sensation in the feet. And that's often how they kind of objectively diagnose peripheral neuropathy, particularly with the diabetic patients. So that there's often a case that this is already understood information. Certainly there are patients who have diabetes and this seems to be a new problem. You may be a clinician who's first kind of thinking, could they be developing neuropathy? And even in patients who are not diagnosed, I spend a lot of time with podiatrists across the way, and I often talk about, is this a potential first symptom of diabetes? And it is possible that a person could have undiagnosed diabetes and then develop neuropathy as a first symptom. Ask that patient, what are your toilet habits like? Do you have unquenching thirst? You know, often they may well be symptomatic of diabetes, and have them have a conversation with their GP.
Absolutely super. Yeah, great. Because as you said, patients with diabetes, some of the signs might be, but they're going to the toilet more often, or they're going to for a wee more often, feeling tired, feeling fatigued and things like that. Great questions to ask when they have those leg pains. Really interesting, Adam, as you said, that they could be the first symptom that shows not only a diabetic neuropathy, but diabetes as a condition in itself. That's really, really interesting stuff. Now, a condition that is becoming more and more talked about with very good reason. I have heard this condition being called the new quadriquina syndrome or the silent quadriquina syndrome because of the fact that it may not be thought about as much as a cause for leg pain, but it totally should be, and how patients are chasing litigation when it's not diagnosed because it really should be. And that is cervical myelopathy, or when we talk about it as DCM, degenerative cervical myelopathy. Would you mind, Adam, talking to us about what this condition is, why it presents with leg pain potentially, and key signs and symptoms?
Yeah, so one of the kind of big proponents is, I think he's called Ben Davies. He's I've got his name wrong there. He's a researcher, but he's a surgeon, and he's often a number of these studies in DCM, and certainly they've got their own charitable website. They've got like a, you can call and ask advice about your condition if you're diagnosed. So he often talks about this. It's a spinal cord injury in slow motion, which I think is an interesting way to talk about it. So it's this very progressive, slow compression, essentially, on the spinal cord, usually in the neck, but very rarely in the thoracic spine. And when spinal cords are compressed, you get quite a different set of signs and symptoms than you would get if you had a compressed nerve root, or if you had a compressed peripheral trunk in the limbs, for instance. So the first thing I would say is you often develop hyperreflexia. So the reflex responses, particularly in the legs, in which is why I always advocate for testing the lower limb reflexes, even in neck patients. They often hyperreflexive. The patients often, this is from an objective perspective, they often develop positive kind of pathological reflexes that some of your guests will be aware of, like Babinski's and inverted reflex sign, Clonus tests, Hoffman's, that kind of thing. From the symptoms perspective, the patient will describe unsteadiness, they may describe falling, they often say that they're losing dexterity in the fingers, they may develop numbness in the fingers, and actually carpal tunnel syndrome is often, this condition's often misdiagnosed as bilateral carpal tunnel syndrome because they develop numbness in the fingers and a loss of dexterity, so kind of fine grip. So dexterity problems, falls, unsteadiness, ataxic gait patterns. Now, when it comes to the lower limb, what I've often found is they may describe heaviness in the legs, they may describe falls, and they may have concurrent lumbar spinal stenosis, but it's often misattributed to lumbar spinal stenosis. And when you take a second to screen their reflexes, for instance, and you ask those questions, you do the tests, they're often DCM patients in disguise. So we need to be screening for these patients. We need to be thinking about the signs and symptoms, because if left, it can deteriorate, and it seldom, you know, regenerates. So early surgery and early diagnosis of these patients is paramount. So yes, we need to be thinking that needs to be on our list.
Absolutely fantastic, Adam. Some really cool points that you've mentioned there. Spinal cord compression in slow motion is a really good one. And you're absolutely right, by the way. It does seem to be Benjamin Davis, who's the clinician you were talking about there. So thank you so much for that. I really like how you described that sometimes patients will actually have lumbar spine stenosis. Maybe they even have an MRI scan that says lumbar spine stenosis. And all the time, someone is not asking them about their neck. So I was then going to ask you, does that mean that we could be asking every single back pain patient about their neck? Of course, we talk about clearing the joints above and below. We talk about ticking the body chart on areas that are asymptomatic, as it were. For any patient with leg pain that may be neurological, does that mean we should be always asking about neck pain? And should we always be doing, as you said, the upper motor neuron test, Hoffman's, Babinski's, Kloner? Should we be doing those for every patient who seems to present with what appears to be spinal leg pain?
So they don't always have neck pain.
Correct. That's true.
So I wouldn't necessarily kind of focus on, do they have neck pain? Do they not have neck pain? I think that we need to just be kind of taking a step back. If our patient says that they feel unsteady, that they're falling, that they have heavy legs, maybe they're describing some dexterity issues, and we can maybe inquire to those things. So big picture initially, and just maybe make us think perhaps we need to consider DCM. In terms of the actual tests, I think that we should be screening. If a patient comes in with a spinal condition, I think we absolutely, the bare minimum, we should be screening their reflexes as a kind of a, we do that with all patients basically. So the basic screening power, we should be doing that with all patients. Only if there is a weight of suspicion, and then maybe the reflex testing then shows up there's some hyperreflexia, only then do I think we should be then deploying all of the additional kind of pathological reflexes. So I don't think we do that with all spinal patients. I think that we look at the history, we form some suspicion, we screen reflexes, and actually do it upper and lower, to be honest. If they've got if they're coming with a neck problem, I'm going to be doing the upper limb reflexes power, and I'll do the lower limb reflexes and power as well. So I'll kind of cover the both bases, and I'll do that with all spinal patients. But everything beyond that, I think, is about clinical suspicion, and if there is reason to go on to do those other tests. One of the reasons for that is you can have a positive false positive Babinski is quite common. Well, it's not quite common, but I've seen that a number of times, whether you appear to have a Hoffman. Do apologize, not Babinski. They seem to have a positive Hoffman. And the question is, why was I looking for it anyway?
Interesting.
So you can put yourself in a awkward situation if you do the test for the wrong reason.
Absolutely fabulous, Adam. Thank you so much. I think it's a really interesting condition, and really interesting, as you said, that sometimes they don't present with neck pain. It is cervical myelopathy in itself is one of those myriad conditions I find, because they could present in so many different ways, like you described. It's a really interesting one, but therefore just goes to show that, as you said, it's something that we really need to put on our radar. So, Adam, thank you so much for taking us through a brilliant run through of these different conditions and the key signs and symptoms that we should be looking at for each of those. Now, you mentioned earlier about your course, and I know that people would be interested in your website. Please do tell us more.
Yeah, so the radiculaclinician.com is my website. I will soon be updating a couple of courses for 2026. I'm doing one in London, and I'll be doing an online one in the it's a kind of international, so that might be of some interest.
I'm sure it will be. Adam, thank you so much for your time. It's always great to have your insights and expertise. Look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Adam for another brilliant episode with some fantastic clinical reasoning insights in there. Now, if you want more on this topic, we have courses such as low back pain differential diagnosis, which I'm sure will really help you to differentiate your patients in practice. Thank you so much for listening. See you soon here on the CP Podcast. Thank you.